Welcome to another edition of On the Money, where we delve into your finance questions and unpack the jargon around business, banks, and the economy. I'm Roderick Chambers, and On the Money is coming to you nationally throughout the Community Radio Network from the studios of Radio 2 SER in Sydney. On the Money, the buck stops with us. On the show this week...
Often I think to myself, why the hell did you sign that contract? And they do it regularly.
We have a look at contracts and what protection you have when you are in a small business. But first, the booming property market in Sydney, and to a lesser extent in Melbourne, is a big contrast to the contracting markets of Perth and the other capitals. But are we in a property bubble then? The government and the Reserve Bank have been reluctant to characterise the over 15% rises in Sydney property prices as a property bubble. RBA Governor Glenn Stevens has a problem when it comes to setting interest rates, as he wants the construction sector to ramp up to counter the falling revenues in mining, but he's rightfully worried about fueling an already red-hot property market in Sydney and Melbourne. Nobel laureate Professor Vernon Smith, who's just published a book on bubbles, has been in Sydney to view ours with Macquarie Graduate School of Management Dean Alex Frino. Alex Frino, Sydney is in a property bubble now, isn't it?
Sydney real estate prices in the last 3 years have risen at 15% per annum. In comparison, in the last 22 years before that, they've risen at 6% per annum, which is kind of in line with nominal GDP growth. The growth we've seen in the last 3 years is unrelated to any reasonable fundamentals. So it looks like the price of Sydney housing has disconnected from fundamentals, and certainly does look like we are in the middle of a bubble. In the last few days, we've hosted a Nobel laureate, Professor Vernon Smith, in Sydney, who's done an enormous amount of research on bubbles. And he's just released a book called Rethinking Housing Bubbles. In it, he explains that bubbles are actually a normal way markets work, that no matter what you do, that bubbles present themselves. So you can burst bubbles by increasing interest rates, by changing tax laws, by introducing regulations, but then you're back to where you were. And his view and his work supports the view that bubbles are just a normal way that markets work.
It may be a normal phenomenon, but why is it so noticeable in Sydney, do you think?
The issue is that in the last few years, we've had very cheap and easy to access cash for the purposes of buying real estate, and because interest rates are at all-time lows, and the presence of cash and easy cash has just fueled purchase of property, particularly in Sydney. And the kinds of price rises we've seen in the last 3 years are virtually unprecedented if you compare them to the previous 22 years. So prices are now increasing at an increasing rate. And according to the work of Professor Vernon Smith, that's pretty characteristic of a bubble.
And who knows Sydney property prices better than New South Wales Real Estate Institute's President Malcolm Gunning. Malcolm, how long will this bubble last?
That's probably the most vexing question and the most asked question. Sydney's now of a large metropolitan area, and the various regions are performing at different levels. The inner city, which really kicked off the boom back in the middle of 2012, that market's now steadied. And what we're seeing is not a lot of price growth in some of those areas. Yet in the new unit market in the inner city, it's very strong. What's driving the market and has done in the last 3 to 6 months is that outside the 20K ring of Sydney, the Hills District, the Shire, southwestern Sydney, because of affordability. Those prices never moved as like the inner city. So it's playing a bit of catch-up. So I think our market's been driven from the bottom up at the moment. It's not from the top down. So that under $1 million market is a really booming market.
We've had the median house prices hit that $1 million mark, but it's actually below that where all the activity, where
correct,
the head is.
Correct. The biggest growth in price in the last few months has been from the Shire and the Upper North Shore. The Upper North Shore underperformed for some time, but with the Northwest Rail Link, well underway with the talk of the tunnel under West Pennant Hills Road, for example, these sorts of things. This has really kicked that market in. And those houses in that Hornsby, Wurunga and those areas, all of a sudden with the low interest, are looking very affordable, particularly with the opportunity of better infrastructure. And then if you look at the southwest, places such as Liverpool or in the new areas of around Camden and those places, you've got good expressways, you've got the new Lippington spur line, that railway line's been opened up. All that's driving those areas. All of a sudden, those houses which are in that $500,000 to $600,000 range, at 4% interest, that you're talking about $20,000 a year in mortgage rates. That's lower than rent. So you've had a catch up. That's driven the market from the bottom up.
So it's not so much investors or Chinese buyers, in your view?
Oh, look, no. I think that also feeds in. More than 50% of the new of the purchases of new real estate, primarily the home units, are investors. Absolutely, that's driven the market. So I think that's impacted, in that lower end. But understand with the Asian investors, their average purchase price is more likely $900,000. So that's a different level of the market.
And are they buying new or are they somehow getting into the existing home market as well?
They're not allowed to buy. If they're foreign investors, they're not allowed to buy the new house unless they're going to knock them over and build. They're primarily buying the new properties. The foreign investors are buying the properties off the plan. They're buying in the Chatswood, the inner city, in that South Sydney area, and also at Parramatta. So now there's a strong appetite from the foreign investors for new, particularly apartments, in that 20K ring of Sydney.
And is that market a bit lumpy? I mean, do you find that there are a number of developments which perhaps come onto the market together, and then so you get this sort of waxing and waning of that sort of market?
It hasn't been. The home unit market's been booming, and it's been driven by the self-managed super funds. They've been buying, then coupled with the foreign investors. The poor old first home buyer makes up about 7% of the market. So they've been beaten up everywhere. The first home buyer's been beaten up, and they're making up a small proportion of the market. It's an area that the Institute's really been lobbying very hard with the government to increase incentives in those areas.
Certainly first-home buyers have been doing it tough, but Alex Freno, as far as the government and the RBA are concerned, they would like the construction sector to really take over from where some of our other sectors like mining and manufacturing have left off. And if we don't have increasing real estate prices, we're not going to see that extra money put into the construction sector, are we?
Yeah, that's a very good point. So The returns that you see in the housing sector do in part fuel speculative activity, which is positive in the sense that people construct and then sell on the marketplace. And indeed, Professor Smith's book argues that it doesn't argue that bubbles are a bad thing. It argues that they can lead to productive investment. They're not something that individuals and society should be frightened of. It's just a natural way things progress. And there are positive externalities from bubbles. So, no, quite right. You're quite right.
And is it characteristic of a bubble in the same way that the American real estate prices were at the GFC?
So American real estate, interestingly enough, wasn't rising at an increasing rate like we're seeing in Sydney right now. So it's literally quite different. So it was rising quite smoothly and increasing at a decreasing rate. If you like, the increase every year was kind of smaller, which is actually a kind of normal bubble. But in Sydney, we're just seeing an acceleration in the price increase. So it's quite characteristic of a bubble.
As you know, Joe Hockey has said that, well, you know, real estate prices aren't unaffordable, otherwise people wouldn't be buying. Is that something you'd concur with?
So Sydney real estate prices, in May, the median house price in Sydney for the first time broke through $1 million. That's the first time it's done that in history. It's clear that it's getting less affordable because the rate of increase in prices is outpacing income increases. So there's no question that affordability is declining. I don't see any data that supports the idea that housing is getting more affordable.
And so should we see then, if it's declining, then should we see a tapering off of these increases?
We should, but the problem is that just money is just quite cheap to access. Housing loans now, the interest rate you can access is in the order of 4%, and that's just 1% above inflation. It's money is very cheap at the moment.
But it's still expensive compared to elsewhere in the world, though, isn't it?
I think that...
you know, like 1%, Japan has 0% and
absolutely.
The US has...
Well, Japan has negative interest rates. In Australia, if you like, if 4% is the rough housing loan rate, inflation running at 3% means your real cost of borrowing is only 1%. That's very, very cheap. But quite true, it is a little bit more expensive than other places in the world, but I think 1% above inflation's very, very cheap money.
It certainly is in historical terms for us here in Australia. Now, Malcolm Gunning, if I could go back to you, are these booming prices filtering down throughout New South Wales?
The northern rivers and the mid-north coast is where we've seen the biggest jump.
And what do you put that down to?
Good infrastructure. You've got, for example, Port Macquarie's now got three airlines that are starting to fly in. And also plenty of work up there with the extension of the Pacific Highway. You've got lots of jobs for professionals and road workers. Those people are now buying houses in those areas and want to stay up there. So there's another 4 or 5 years of major construction in that upper north coast. So many of those high-paying workers are buying property in those areas. In places such as Orange, is education, strong tourism. Bathurst now has a train that runs to Sydney, albeit 3 hours. So what we're starting to see is the telecommuters starting to move in those areas too. So the other side of the coin is we've got a booming Sydney market, but also you're finding where there's jobs, people are now moving out of the cities. The Southern Highlands had a major lift in prices.
Of course, if interest rates go up, and there are signs that the US is going to raise their interest rates, and then the RBA is saying, well, you know, we might like to increase ours. So what happens then, you know, in 2 or 3 years with people that have bought on this interest rate? Are they going to be able to afford to keep paying their mortgages?
Well, that's, again, an interesting question. But if interest rates go up, it means that we have inflation. Inflation means increasing wages. So if we had a drop in price and a rapid increase in interest rates, there'd be an issue. That's not likely in the near future. So if we see interest rates going up, means that we have inflation above 3%, for example. So I think that we're not going to see a rapid swing around. What we will see is growth in wages, which will then be able, in most cases, the purchasers will be able to afford to pay more in interest rates. But the other thing, Rob, the banks are actually taking notice of APRA, and many of the banks now are assessing the ability to buy property at an interest rate of 7%. So what they're saying is, well, we're going to assess your ability to afford this loan, not at an interest rate of 4%, but an interest rate of 7%.
So, and also some banks are clamping down on their lending to investors too, aren't they?
They are. They're looking for 20% deposit. So what the banks are doing now is building in that buffer. So the lending policies of the big four are starting to infiltrate into the market. That's not going to stop the foreign investor. That's a different criteria, but the local investor or the local home buyer or what we call the upsizer, they're going to have to be able to afford a mortgage rate of about 7%. So the banks are building a buffer.
But you would expect some sort of levelling out or dropping at some stage in the future, wouldn't you?
We're starting to see a levelling out of prices in the inner city. So in that 5K ring of Sydney, what we're starting to see now is vendor expectations start to exceed buyer expectation. I think what's going to be interesting, Rod, is in September, in spring, to see how the clearance rates hold up. I'm of the opinion we're probably going to see clearance rates come down from those heady 80% to more likely in sort of your 60 to 70%, which is pretty much a neutral market then.
So if there is a structural basis for some of these prices, then in New South Wales, we could be looking at a soft landing rather than a bust. But if we take note of Nobel Prize winner Vernon Smith, he's saying that we should allow the bubble to deflate and sort of just ride it out, Alex Freno?
That's exactly right. So Vernon Smith's view is that bubbles occur. They have positive consequences as well as negative consequences when they burst. And there's not much regulators can do to prevent them. They can burst them, which has its own problems. So, indeed, that is his advice. You just keep riding them out. It's an interesting worldview.
It is, and it's a new idea, I would think, for some of the people in Treasury and the RBA. Don't you agree?
I think we often hear central banks talk about wanting to burst bubbles, and they probably want to do that to prevent the severe adverse consequences you see when bubbles burst. But the Vernon Smith view of the world is that there are positive things that can come out of bubbles. So, yeah, just ride them out and let them run their course.
That was Professor Alex Freno, Dean of the Macquarie Graduate School of Management, ending that story. I'm Roderick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money, broadcast nationally throughout the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2 SER. You often hear that small business is the backbone of the Australian economy, with over 2 million small businesses currently operating. Yet until now, many small businesses have been left vulnerable to larger businesses asserting their unfair contract terms for their own benefit. Now the federal government has taken the first step to addressing unfair contracts, with Minister for Small Business Bruce Bilson introducing amendments to consumer protection laws to cover small business. Tanya Katsanis reports.
Consumers have been protected from unfair contract terms since 2010. But until now, small businesses have often been faced with take-it-or-leave-it terms when entering into commercial contracts. Now the consumer laws are being amended to allow businesses with less than 20 employees entering into a contract up to the value of $100,000 or up to $250,000 for a multi-year contract to take their contract to court if they think it's unfair. Small Business Minister Bruce Bilson explains.
In many cases, a small business has no more power, no more negotiating grunt than an individual consumer in their dealings with bigger businesses, yet they don't have the protection of unfair contract terms protections that are available to consumers. So we're seeking to carry over those consumer protections to cover small businesses when they are, frankly, functioning in their day-to-day operations with no more power than a consumer.
Small business who think they have an unfair contract will now be able to take their contract to the Australian Competition and Consumer Commission, no matter which state they live in.
What would happen was an individual business or their industry association would bring a take-it-or-leave-it standard term contract to the attention of the ACCC, point to the terms that they feel are unfair. Unfair is where they are basically subject to the grunt and the strengthened bargaining position of the other party to see terms included in there that damage the small business and have no legitimate business justification for being there. They are the kinds of terms that be taken to the ACCC. The ACCC will have its assessment and then ordinarily would go back to the party that was instigating that standard form, take or leave it contract and suggest that they change it.
The ability to take an unfair contract to the ACCC means there's now consistent process for business across the country. But the minister says if your contract does not have an unfair clause but is in dispute, you'll be redirected to your state-based Small Business Commissioner for mediation.
Or if that's not possible, we've currently got legislation before the Parliament for a Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman that may be of use in resolving those disputes so that they don't have to go to court, because we all know when a small business is involved with a court action involving a bigger business, the outcome invariably is one of hardship.
It is. And in those instances, I think with small businesses, they're discouraged to take legal action because they don't have the time, they don't have the money, and they just don't want to bring their business into disrepute.
Well, and the other thing too is it takes them away from focusing on their business. What the best outcome is where a business dispute arises is get it resolved quickly. Get the parties around a table, see if it can be mediated, see if there's some way of getting the grievance resolved, and people can get back to business. And that's what we're trying to create, the right environment for that, through these unfair contract terms protections, through the measures such as the Small Business and Family Enterprise Ombudsman, and through specific changes like we've introduced in the franchising area and with the Food and Grocery Code of Conduct, where we're trying to get those supply chain pressures right so that there's healthy mutual respect between businesses who want to compete and contest with vigour, but we don't want to see it end up going beyond that into an area that's unhealthy and quite damaging.
Minister for Small Business, Bruce Bilson. The new laws will allow small businesses to seek mediation before having to go to court, a process which has often been both daunting and off-putting. Jackie Attard is Executive Officer at the Southern Sydney Business Enterprise Centre. She's seen many small businesses get stuck when faced with what they think is an unfair contract.
Often you'll find that businesses, when they are faced with, say, an unfair contract or put themselves in a position where they're unsure of their rights, they either do one of three things. They either do nothing, and sometimes doing nothing is always the easiest option because, you know, small business people are really busy, or the other option is to go to court. Going to court can be quite expensive. So small business operators tend to find themselves in a position of weighing up the costs of going to court and then think that potentially doing nothing again is the option. Or the third option is that they sort of seek out somebody who can be an impartial mediator for them. And that this is where I think the change to the legislation will assist small business operators.
Jackie Attard says the new federal laws are being modelled on the process already used in New South Wales, which she says has been quite successful in resolving small business contract disputes.
Within New South Wales, the process is that you bring up a mediator. The mediator then hears your story and then works on behalf of the small business operator to help mediate their problem. So they take on the dispute. And what's happened, which makes the New South Wales model so successful, is that if a small business operator rings a large firm, so a large insurance firm, they get fobbed off, they can get the ring around. But somebody from the government ringing up on behalf of the small business operator, things just shift and they get a hearing, they get listened to. And what we found once clients of ours that we've referred into the dispute resolution team have had resolution very quickly because of that assistance.
Jackie Attard says having a mediator in New South Wales has been very popular, with the Small Business Commissioner taking over 18,000 calls last year alone, which she says shows just how many small businesses feel their contracts are unfair.
The issues of disempowerment that small business people have when it comes to dealing with bigger corporates, I think that the more help that small business can get, that helps them feel like they're at an equal playing field, the better, because it's highly inefficient for them and corporates understand that and so they do take advantage of them. So I can only see bills like this as being successful for the small business operator. The other thing, though, that I've got to stress is that you really want to set things up for yourself so you don't get yourself in dispute when you are in small business, and to seek advice and to invest in getting the right advice so that you are protected. And often small business people sometimes shortcut because they think it's easier and quicker, but in the long run it's sometimes better to go slow before they go fast.
Jackie Attard, Executive Officer at the Southern Sydney Business Enterprise Centre. Joe Cafruni is the director of Cafruni Lawyers. His experience in contract law for small business led him to change his mind on their need for consumer-like protection.
I had some reservations initially because generally I'm of the view that people should be able to contract on whatever they like. But small businesses are at a disadvantage because they don't have the same resources to negotiate as larger businesses, and they don't perceive the risk of a deal the same way that a larger business might, because they don't have the collective experience to know what could happen if they sign on the dotted line. And often they believe that contracts are submitted on a take-it-or-leave-it basis, they don't actually realise sometimes that they have the opportunity to negotiate.
So in terms of the government actually capping small business contracts to $100,000 or $250,000 for multi-year contracts, do you think that's a fair capping?
I do, and I think there's got to come a point where businesses have to do their due diligence and have to get legal advice. But there has to come a point where, you know, small businesses, even though they're disadvantaged in negotiations, have to take responsibility and have to undertake the due diligence and incur the cost perhaps with lawyers to get the legal advice. And I think that's a fair threshold, because having to go to a lawyer regularly for standard form contracts can be very costly. And at least knowing that there is provision to protect a small business, you know, up to those thresholds, will generally mean that whilst not incurring the costs of getting legal advice, they do have a form of legal protection.
Joe Cafruni says businesses shouldn't leave getting advice until after they've signed on the dotted line.
Often I think to myself, why the hell did you sign that contract? And they do it, and they do it regularly. They either don't want to incur the cost initially because they don't see the risk, or they think that they can't negotiate it, so what's the point of spending the money?
Joe Cafruni from Cafruni Lawyers. For Small Business Minister Bruce Bilson, looking at aspects of competition law is next.
But there's also a lot of work going on where we're promoting good commercial and good corporate conduct, paying your bills on time, you know, recognising that many big businesses are heavily reliant on the success and vitality of small business, and then getting other measures right, such as the banking code of conduct, areas where, you know, big institutions have a big bearing on the success of small business, getting that right so that the parties know that a small business is crucial to our future economic prospects, but they don't have teams of lawyers and big compliance departments, and they should be dealt with respect and in a proportionate way. So that work continues, and it even includes the way government institutions and agencies conduct themselves.
Minister for Small Business there, Bruce Bilson, ending that report by Tanya Katsanis. You're listening to On The Money, broadcast nationally throughout the Community Radio Network and produced in the studios of Radio 2SER. I'm Roderick Chambers. Well, that's it for another week of On The Money. Thanks for your company. Tune in again next week when we investigate anything and everything to do with money, finance or business. I'm Roderick Chambers. Have a good week.